So, do things ever go wrong for you? Well, that was an easy answer. I find they go wrong with me a lot, even when I'm actually oblivious to it, and I don't even know they've gone wrong yet, right? Back on a long weekend in July, see, Dar and I have started hiking a little bit together, which is great fun, but I have this dream that she's going to love overnight backpacking. So this, how hard can this be, right? This is going to be great. We're going to love doing this together. So we went out in July, and we did this trip up to Elfin Lakes, which was great. It's not too far. You can kind of handle it. You get up there. It's a nice place to stay. It's going to be great. We're going to carry the tent and do all this, and Dar's going to fall in love with backpacking and hiking. So we did all this trip, right? And I came back. I had a fantastic time, right? And I remember sitting, and we were talking to a couple, and I can't remember who it was. It might have been Christian. It might have been you and Brooke. I can't remember that. Maybe it was Adrian and Jackie. I can't remember. We were sitting talking, and they're saying, how was your backpacking trip? And I go, it was, and as I'm doing this, Dar goes, well, I don't even know that it went well. I thought it went great, right? So I have these images of all these fun things that went on. It was great. It was exciting. We were having a good time. It was a great trip we're hiking on, great views, great vistas. And Dar said, well, actually, it rained the entire time, which I'd kind of forgotten a little bit. The clouds had settled in over the mountains. You couldn't see anything. We hiked across snow most of the time. Couldn't stay in the tent, so we had to stay in the shelter with 15 people she didn't even know and use outhouses that were full of flies. I'm like, oh, okay. Things didn't go quite as well, right? And I was kind of oblivious to the whole thing. So sometimes in our life, things go wrong, and they're trivial, right? But that's clearly not major. But things go wrong in our life. But sometimes things go wrong and they're much more significant. They have a bigger impact on our life, right? It took like 10 seconds of sort of reviewing world news, and you see some things that go wrong in the world. And we were praying about a couple of things this morning. What's going on in Russia, where they're just closing back down on Christianity and religion in Russia, and it's becoming illegal to share your faith, and there'll be persecution in major ways. People I know there, this is going to impact them, right? What's going on with terrorism and ISIS around the world? People being slaughtered for their faith or just for innocence. Horrible things going on around the world. Don't get me started with watching U.S. politics. Although I'd like to get real haughty about it, and then I look at Canadian politics and go, well, maybe not. Right? Is racism reemerging as we look at Black Lives Matter and all the things around all that? Like, what's going on in the world? Are things going wrong worldwide? But beyond worldwide, what about you and me, really, in our lives, right? There's stuff that's hitting each one of us all the time. Things go wrong. Housing prices. That's creating real tension for people right here in this room, right? That hurts for a lot of people. Your kids trying to get into their careers and struggling, trying to get into the right university courses and what comes next. And if that doesn't work, now what's going to happen? And we worry about these things. Trying to figure out how to live your faith, how to live your faith out in the world, and sometimes not doing very well, right? And feeling guilty about that or not knowing how does this actually really play out in my Monday to Saturday? Never mind my Sunday, and we don't do well. Things go wrong. Health issues that impact your whole life. Things you didn't see coming for you or maybe your kids that hit you right between the eyes, right? Or your parents. Financial stress, pressure at school or with friends who think you're nuts just for going to church. And how do I deal with that? How do I handle that? How do I live my life out really when things actually go wrong? But see, this is the real world. This is the world that Paul, we've been listening as we go through Acts, we're following Paul, right? And as he goes through his life, this is his real world. Almost every day of his life, things are going wrong. It's not like this nicely planned out. You know, we often think of Paul's missionary journeys, and we look at them, we plan them out, and we go, oh yeah, he went from here to here to here, we had this nice plan. Most of it's not. Most of his things going disastrously long. He gets shoved in some ship somewhere and taken to another prison and off to somewhere else, and things are going wrong. And then we look back later and go, well, that's Paul's missionary journey, so it was nicely planned, right? But how does Paul handle that? Like, how does he live with this? He seems to live at peace with it, right? He kind of goes from day to day, catastrophe to catastrophe, and things just, he lives at peace. How does he do that? Last week, J.D. brought us up to speed with where we're at, right? He's in a bring us through Acts 23, and Paul is once again taken before the religious council, right, and have the Sadducees and the Pharisees, and they're going, they found a common enemy in Paul, right? So Paul was brilliant. I don't know how intentional this was, but Paul just chooses sides and gets them to fight each other, right? He sides up with the Pharisees and gets these guys going after each other, and they start tearing apart each other. And the tribune, who's looking after the city, right? He's the guardian of the city, comes in. He has to drag Paul out of there before he literally gets ripped apart, brings him back to the barracks to hold him safe. And as Paul is there, the Lord comes before him, right, at the very end, in chapter 23, verse 11. And the Lord stands, Jesus stands by him and says, "Take courage, for as you've testified to the facts about me in Jerusalem, so you must testify in Rome." Right? This is what leads us up to where we're at today. So now Paul's kind of stuck in the barracks, right? But he's given this word from Jesus that you're going to go to Rome. You're going someplace here. By the way, this is just a little aside. Notice that when Paul testified, like he's before the council, he wasn't successful at all. He was faithful, but he wasn't successful. Like the council didn't go, "Oh, I get it," right? "You're right. What are we thinking," right? You know, that didn't happen with Paul, right? But he was faithful in testifying. And Jesus comes before him and says, "Take heart." It's nice to know that Paul needed that, right? So that kind of leads us up to where we're at today. And we're in Acts chapter 23. And I'm going to start about verse 12. I said to Steve, "Thanks very much," because you read the subtitle, "A Plot to Kill Paul." Hey, thanks for the section. Anyway, that's where we're at. So Paul's just been thrown in jail by the tribune, right? He's there overnight. When it was day, it doesn't take long, right? This is the next morning. When it was day, the Jews made a plot and bound themselves by an oath neither to eat nor drink till they had killed Paul. There were more than 40 who made this conspiracy. They went to the chief priests and elders and said, "We have strictly bound ourselves by an oath to taste no food till we have killed Paul. Now, therefore, you, along with the council, give notice to the tribune to bring him down to you as though you were going to determine his case more exactly, and we are ready to kill him before he comes near." That kind of sounds like things going wrong, doesn't it? So Paul's in jail. Like, really, there's 40. Like, it's probably like 40-ish people there, right? How easy is it to get 40 people to agree on anything, right? But now you've got 40 people who are willing, literally, to not eat, not drink, do nothing until they've literally killed Paul, who is under Roman guard at the time, right? So they know that probably a bunch of them are going to die in this process. They are so worked up, so hot under the collar, right? This is serious. Paul's under this Roman protection. And not only that, they get the religious council to go along. Fascinating, right? Like, they bring this idea. 40 of us have got together, at least 40, says more than 40. I've got together, and they come to the religious leaders and say, "Here's the deal. We're going to kill Paul, and here's how you're going to help." And the religious leaders go along. It's fascinating to watch. Paul has laid out for them all previously, here's who Jesus is. He says, "I'm not against you. I love you dearly. I want you to know who Jesus is," right? And the religious leaders hear it, right? And they don't stop and consider it. They sort of double down, right? "No way. We're coming after you," right? It's fascinating to me. The religious leaders go along, and they said, this group of 40 plus, we're ready to kill him before he comes near. In verse 16, it says, "Now the son of Paul's sister heard of their ambush, so he went and entered the barracks and told Paul." Can I just pause here for a second? Wait a second. Paul has a family? Where'd this... Paul's sister... He's got a sister, he's got a... Are you like me? Like, every once in a while, I kind of look at some of these, the apostles and the great heroes of the Bible, and I look at them kind of like these disembodied individuals who just kind of, like, floated around and did stuff, right? Well, this is Paul's sister, who's apparently in Jerusalem, you've never heard of till now, shows up, and so his nephew is some kid, right? It's kind of fascinating to me that Paul, like, he's a real person with family. And one of the things, kind of a side things I kind of wonder is, what was it like in that family gathering, right? So here's Paul, the zealot, right? Back up a while, right? So Saul, Right? The zealot, the Pharisee, going after the Christians, because this is the right thing to do, persecuting, having them killed, thrown in jail. He's a zealot, right? My guess is, okay, so take that for what it's worth, right? Like, the family's quite supportive of this. Right? This is part of the deal, right? At some stage, Paul meets Jesus, falls in love with Jesus, right? And becomes Paul as we know him now. What does his family think now? Right? How does he get along with his sister? Right? Ro and I get along pretty well, but I'm sure we'd have a few spats, right? So how does this relationship work? But in the meantime, for some reason, right, his nephew is able to overhear this plot. As we'll see in a second, his nephew is not like some middle-aged person who's part of the thing. He's probably a kid, right? Some reason, we'll come back to the idea of some reason, right? The son of Paul's sister heard of their ambush, so he went and entered the barracks and told Paul. So is this luck? Is this luck that this little nephew, man, that's fortunate, right? If that hadn't happened, right, what would have happened next? Man, Paul is a lucky guy, right? If that, whew. So is it actually coincidence that Paul's nephew overhears? Or is this God's providence? Sometimes we look at our life, right, and we look at things that we go, well, that was fortunate how that worked out, or unfortunate. Maybe it's neither of those things. Maybe almost all the time it's God's providence, right? God actually having his hand on Paul in the middle of difficult stuff, right? God has his hand on Paul as he does on you, as he does on me. We can look at these life and just call these things luck, right? Or we can recognize God's hand in every moment of our life. We can look for where God is at work and follow him, just like Jesus did, right? You remember Jesus in John chapter 5, verse 9, he says, I tell you the truth, the Son, Jesus, right? The Son can do nothing by himself. He does only what he sees the Father doing. This is true for Jesus, it's true for Paul, and it should be true for you and me. Can we open our eyes, like, as we're going through when things go wrong, and see Jesus is at work, God is at work in our life, when things look like they're going wrong, as they do for Paul right now? I think this next verse is kind of a key for me in this little passage. It's not a long passage, really. It's not really a long story. It's kind of a transition piece. But in the middle of all this, you have Paul, who's under attack from 40 people, who has the entire religious council behind them, right? And fortunately, his little nephew overhears, somehow gets into the barracks, right? Tells Paul what's going on. Paul called one of the centurions and said, "Take this young man to the tribune, for he has something to tell him." In this whole passage, that's it from Paul's response. Paul listens to the nephew, this kid, right? And turns to one of the centurions. And the centurions looks after about 100 guards, right? So it's interesting that Paul actually has a lot of influence for some reason. They have caught that there's something about Paul, right? So he calls the centurion and says, "Can you take my nephew, right, and take him to the tribune, who's overseeing the city, right, and pass on the story?" And that's where Paul leaves it. Right? The rest of stuff happens here. But Paul seems to be quite willing and able to be at rest. It's kind of fascinating to me. Is that how I would respond, or would you respond that way? Like, if you had discovered there's 40 people, you're in jail here, there's 40 people out there with a serious plot with an oath to kill you, I'd probably be banging on the door and doing whatever else I need. Like, somebody, listen here. Like, I'm a pretty good orator. This is not me. This is Paul, right? Let me go speak to the tribune. I can convince them, right? Right. This clearly needs, I need to step in here. I need to fix this. I need to do everything I can. And Paul doesn't. He sends his nephew, "Hey, can you take my nephew to the tribune? He's got something he should probably share with him." And Paul knows the nature of the threat, right? Like, this isn't something, he's not like unaware of how serious. Paul was those guys. Like, the 40 guys who are outside and hiding, that was Paul not long ago, tracking down the church. He was one of them. He was More than that, he was the most zealous one there was. He knows the nature of the threat. They are just like Paul, right? These people who are trying to track him down and kill him. But his response to the threat is not fear, it's not anger. He simply sends his nephew on to pass his message on to the tribune, right? And he's at peace with the outcome. It seems like that's kind of Paul's normal state. When life has gone wrong, right? And Paul is at peace. There's something. So in a few years, he writes, throughout the book of Acts, he's writing to various places. Like he writes Romans during the book of Acts, and he writes to various churches. In a couple of years, he's going to write this to the Philippians. But I think it reveals Paul's inner heart. Like, how is he able to live like this, right? So this is in Philippians 1. I'll read a few verses here and there. He says, I want you to know, brothers, that what has happened to me has really served to advance the gospel, so that it has become known throughout the whole imperial guard and to all the rest that my imprisonment is for Christ. And most of the brothers, having become confident in the Lord by my imprisonment, are much more bold to speak the word without fear. And later on, it is my eager expectation and hope that I will not be ashamed, but that with full courage, now as always, Christ will be honored in my body, whether by life or by death. For me, to live is Christ, and to die is gain. If I am to live in the flesh, that means fruitful labor for me, for which I shall choose, I cannot tell. I'm hard pressed between the two. My desire is to depart and be with Christ, for that is far better. But to remain in the flesh is more necessary on your account. Now that's Paul talking to the Philippians in a couple of years, but I think it reflects his heart now. It's an amazing ability he has to act at peace in the midst of craziness, right? And in the midst of disaster. And things that look unsolvable. So I have this question. So it all sounds very noble, and that's great, and I can read that as a Bible story, and wow, that's impressive. But how is that actually possible? Like, is it possible for me to live like that? And if so, how? Like, how can I do that when things are crashing down around me, right? I think every time we see Paul, and it's reflected here, and we see it in every other instance of his life, he has at least four characteristics that come through him all the time and give him this ability to live at peace. The first one is that I think Paul has the most clear picture of Jesus, who he really is, and it changed his life. Right? When Paul was a zealot and on the road to Damascus, and Jesus met him face to face, Paul saw Jesus. He met him and he fell in love with Jesus. It wasn't Paul's internal courage, my ability to pull myself up by the bootstraps and just live through stuff and whatever else. His vision, his focus was somewhere else completely. Paul loved Jesus and could see him. He knew who Jesus really was. He saw Jesus for who he really was. He saw Jesus as the one who was willing to die for him while he was still a sinner. And so while Paul's in the act of actually chasing down the Christians, Jesus forgives him. Right? This Jesus who was actually in the garden before being crucified, pleading with God, can we change the plan? Right? But said, but no. For the love of these people, not my will, but yours be done. Paul could see him. I think it's amazing, just the view that Paul had to recognize the amazing love, the relentless pursuit of Jesus. Even while we run from him or intentionally fight him or forget. Jesus is constantly pursuing you. And I think that's what gave Paul this ability. He constantly had that picture of Jesus in front. Don't focus on here. Focus on Jesus. The other thing was true for him, the second one, I think, was he Heaven was a reality for him. He thought about heaven a lot. Even in the verse, he says, for me to die is gain? What is, where, what? He's thinking about heaven all the time. And as he writes to the Corinthian church, he says, I'd rather be away from the body and at home with the Lord. He means it. He says it a lot in different kinds of passages. Paul's focus isn't here. He realized he's temporary. I'm just passing through here. I'm going to heaven. I'm going to be with the Lord. That's where I'm going to be. All this other stuff, we're just on the journey. And Paul actually believed it, knew it to be true, and lived that way. I think the third thing, too, is that Paul had an amazing journey, right? I mean, as we've gone through Acts, you see some, and there's more to come, right? But Paul had learned to trust in God's providence in his life. Through the storms of his life, Paul saw God's providence, remembered it, and trusted it. So when the little nephew shows up, does Paul look at that and go, man, that was lucky, right? I don't think so. Paul goes, huh, I was wondering, how is this going to work out, right? Oh, my nephew showed up. Haven't seen him for a while. But Paul's missionary journeys, right, they're a whole story of God's providence. It just keeps going from one to the next to the next. You actually, if you plotted them, you would just see God's providence happening again and again and again. And this piece of the nephew showing up is just another piece of it. And I think the fourth thing that carried through Paul through all this stuff, all the attacks against him, was that Paul had an unbelievably deep love for those people who didn't yet know Jesus. So when he's standing before the council and he's arguing, he's not arguing because he just likes to argue. He deeply cares for every single one who is there, who have not yet encountered Jesus. And he's willing to put all on the line, everything on the line, to bring them to know Jesus. The one you're seeking for, why you have all this religion built around you, you've missed the point. He's right here. You must meet him. I love this in Romans chapter 9, verse 1 to 5. This is Paul. He says, I'm speaking the truth in Christ. I'm not lying. My conscience bears me witness in the Holy Spirit that I have great sorrow and unceasing anguish in my heart. For I could wish that I myself were accursed and cut off from Christ for the sake of my brothers, my kinsmen according to the flesh. They are Israelites, and to them belong the adoption, the glory, the covenants, the giving of the law, the worship, and the promises. To them belong the patriarchs, and from their race according to the flesh is the Christ, who is God over all, blessed forever. Amen. It sounds like love to me. Paul loves his kinsmen. He loves them dearly. The 40 people who are outside, right, coming after him, if he could give his life and they would believe and meet Jesus, he would do it. So when Paul is able to live at peace and kind of go from one step to the next and have catastrophe happen, right, he's not just personally brave. It's not just like, oh, there's Paul, he's this guy, we can't actually be like him. He's different because he's actually met and seen and fallen in love with Jesus. He lives with a picture of heaven, right, in his head all the time. He has seen God's providence in his life. He trusts it. He knows it's true. And he desperately loves those who are lost. That's how Paul lives. It's interesting. Those are characteristics that I think we can actually live with ourselves. The catch is you develop them now and they get tested later, right? It doesn't sort of work to sort of try to figure that out once you're in trouble and once things have actually gone wrong, right? I'm trying to remember the quote. I think it was Tozer. He said something along the lines of like, When we're really overwhelmed, we forget how big God is. And so now is the time to build that faith, to build that relationship. It's like when you do physical workouts and stuff. You grow stronger through testing, through being pushed, through going a little further than you used to be able to go. So as you spend your time now getting to know Jesus, search for him now and get to know him so that when you are tested, it strengthens you. It doesn't weaken you. You don't get stronger by living a life of ease, right? You get stronger through the tests. So as Paul sort of in this verse is just sort of says, oh, by the way, send my nephew off, right? Seems like trivial. But to be able to do that and live that way is extraordinary, right? So what happens? He sends his nephew off, and then so what happens next? When Paul trusts in God's providence, right? Paul could have taken over from this step, but he doesn't. Because God has brought him here. Let's see what God does from here, right? So in verse 18, so now we've got the centurion taking this nephew off, right? So the centurion. So he took him and brought him to the tribune and said, Paul, the prisoner, called me and asked me to bring this young man to you, as he has something to say to you. The tribune took him by the hand and, going aside, asked him privately, what is it that you have to tell me? I love telling stories. I can kind of picture this one, right? This tribune taking this little guy, right? Taking him by the hand. And some people wonder how old was the nephew, right? I think it's interesting here. The tribune takes him by the hand. So if this nephew's my son's age, he's not taking him by the hand anywhere. Right? That ain't going to work. So I'm guessing he's younger, right? The tribune took him by the hand and going aside, asked him privately. You can kind of picture him, right? Just kind of kneeling down, putting his arm around. So what is it, son? Like, what's going on, right? You kind of picture that kind of scenario. What is it you have to tell me? And he said, the Jews have agreed to ask you to bring Paul down to the council tomorrow as though they were going to inquire somewhat more closely about him. But do not be persuaded by them, for more than 40 of their men are lying in ambush for him, who have bound themselves by an oath neither to eat nor drink till they have killed him. And now they're ready, waiting for your consent. So the tribune dismissed the young man, charging him, tell no one that you have informed me of these things, right? So I think it's really interesting. Paul's nephew obviously is a young little guy, right? How is it that somebody that young becomes such a significant part of God's providence, right? Sometimes we wait, everything in God's providence has to be bigger and bolder and more significant and whatever else. It's not, right? In this case, it's some kid who managed to overhear somehow, right? Comes and tells Paul, follows the centurion, goes and tells the tribune, who's the overall governor of the whole place. So how does the tribune respond? Verse 23, verse 24. This is the tribune, right, who's looking over the city. Then he called two of the centurions and said, get ready 200 soldiers with 70 horsemen and 200 spearmen to go as far as Caesarea at the third hour of the night. Also provide mounts for Paul to ride and bring him safely to Felix the governor. Okay, I got to tell you, I love this. Like, do the math for a second, right? So Paul's got 40 people out there, right? The tribune, who probably looks after 1,000 soldiers or so to guard Jerusalem, right, from uprising and all this kind of stuff. It's probably about 1,000 or something like that. The tribune says, okay, go get 200 soldiers, 200 spearmen, 70 cavalry, 470. He's taking half of his available resources, right, to guard Paul. Okay, that's kind of funny, right? I mean, here's the plot to wipe out Paul. And we now have the Roman guards arming up, 470 of them. When this place is actually packed to the gunnels, right? I think we're allowed to have 450 people in here, something like that, right? 470 and horses and all the gear and everything else, right? All set to take Paul over to Caesarea, right? So he collects all of it. And Paul gets to ride, right? So by the way, make sure you get all the stuff for Paul. He gets a nice horse to ride. It seems like overkill, right? It's kind of interesting, though. God's providence at work. send the little kid, have the tribune take over, send him off. And you can kind of smile, right? And at this stage of the game, you can kind of smile. So then the tribune, as he's going to send off the soldiers, right? He writes a letter to send to Felix the governor. Clodius Lysias, that's the tribune, to His Excellency the governor Felix, greetings. This man was seized by the Jews and was about to be killed by them when I came upon them with the soldiers and rescued him, having learned that he was a Roman citizen. I don't know if you remember. He's kind of skipping a couple of parts. The part where he was about to flog him to death kind of gets neglected here, right? But okay, I don't blame him, right? I came upon him with the soldiers and rescued him, having learned that he was a Roman citizen. And desiring to know the charge for which they were accusing him, I brought him down to their council. I found that he's being accused about questions of their law, but charged with nothing deserving death or imprisonment. And when it was disclosed to me that there was to be a plot against the man, I sent him to you at once, ordering his accusers also to state before you what they have against him. I think it's interesting. This little passage just kind of summarizes God's providence in so many ways, right? How God's hand is on Paul. Paul being seized by the Jews in the first place is why the centurion had to go in there and the tribune had to go in there and save him. The tribune needing to save him, so dragging him out, bringing him back to the barracks. The fact that Paul actually was a Roman citizen as well as being a Pharisee, all these are very providential steps that allowed all these steps to happen. The very plot to kill Paul being the reason to transfer Paul to Caesarea. Right? There wouldn't have been a reason to do that if this plot hadn't happened. Interesting looking backwards, right? The nephew overhearing the plot, being willing to tell Paul, right? All this is just kind of a step-by-step showing of God's providence in life and that Paul lives with all the time. And then they wrap it up like this. It says, so the soldiers, according to the instructions, took Paul and brought him by night to Antipatris. And on the next day they returned to the barracks, letting the horsemen go on with him. When they had come to Caesarea and delivered the letter to the governor, they presented Paul also before him. On reading the letter, he asked what province he was from. And when he learned that he was from Cilicia, he said, I will give you a hearing when your accusers arrive. And he commanded him to be guarded in Herod's Praetorium. That's where we're in today. Just a little side, just for kind of curiosity, right? So they send 470 soldiers to guard Paul, and they go to Antipatris, however you want to say that. It's about 60 kilometers. And he sends them out at 9 o'clock at night. Like, the tribune's not kidding around, right? Like, get him out of here now before these guys attack him. So they walk 60 kilometers to Abbotsford, basically, right? They start at 9 o'clock at night and go for a walk to Abbotsford. The soldiers get to turn around and walk home. At least half of them do, right? The next morning. The tribune just all hands on deck, guarding, protecting God's messenger to get him to where he needs to be. And Paul lives this way. It's his life. And I think that's, out of the whole thing, the most fascinating, that Paul is able to see in the difficult, he sees Jesus all the time, first and foremost. He lives in a different place. He lives with the anticipation of heaven. He's not living in the current. He's living in the future, right? He sees God's providence happen from day to day, and he has a deep love for those around him. I think it's interesting. Augustine has this neat little saying. A quote from Augustine says, we can trust the past to the mercy of God, the present to his love, and the future to his providence. And it's how Paul lived. It's how we can actually live. Right? It's not because Paul was a great guy. It's because we can actually see Jesus. Paul lived as if he was immortal until he had completed the work God had called him to do. Right? He knew he was. And he lived that way. There's nothing going to happen to Paul that's not outside of God's hand. And that's true for you. So how can we live this way today? Right? Is this possible? Can we live as if we're immortal? Right? There's nothing going to happen to you. God has you. And if horrible things happen to you, you're still in God's hand. Don't get overwhelmed when things happen to you and forget how big God is. These understandings of seeing Jesus and living with the picture of heaven and seeing his providence, right, and loving one another are characteristics that we can develop now. Spend time with Jesus now so that when we are tested, you are strengthened by it, not weakened by it.